Welcome to Three Women, Three Ways. I'm your host, Heather Stark. I have a guest with me today who's done some interesting research, some research that really catches my eye because it's so prevalent anymore. We have with us Emma Louise Bakke. She's a PhD candidate at George Washington University's Anthropology Department, and her doctoral research deals with the politics and temporalities, I'm going to ask you to explain what that means, of care provided to survivors of intimate partner violence in Cape Town, South Africa, as well as the forms of restorative justice enabled or inhibited by international aid to survivors. She's a trained rape crisis advocate and a community educator, and she serves as a gender consultant in the international development and global health sectors. So that's quite a resume. Lots of big words in there. Tell us in everyday language, not academic language, what it is you do and what your research is in.
Sure. I wear a lot of different hats. In terms of my research. So broadly, most of my research deals with gender-based violence and issues of mental health and care. I spend a lot of time thinking about care. My research that I conduct in South Africa is basically interested in what kinds of care are offered to survivors of intimate partner violence. When I say temporality, it's a sort of ethnographic term that I'm throwing around, in part because I think that time plays a really critical role in not only survivors' experiences of violence, but also what kinds of care they are able to get access to, and how much this emphasis on sort of a crisis-oriented model of care or emergency care, which we're seeing a lot right now, especially during the COVID epidemic, that actually shortens the amount of time that survivors are able to get access to other kinds of services over the long term. So I think a lot about the role that time plays in recovery for survivors.
Mm-hmm. What brought me to your attention, or what brought you to my attention, was a paper that you recently did. It's a meta-analysis, a meta-study of all of the literature that deals with cyber stalking. And I thought, wow, here's a woman who sees the whole picture. And so I wanted you to come on the show and talk about that. We've done brief shows before on cyber stalking, but the whole cyber violence, the whole cyber world is so much more comprehensive than just the stalking. What got you interested in this topic, and what led you to doing this comprehensive literature review of all the research that's been done?
Sure. So I think that this is – so I self-identify as a geek. One of the other hats that I also wear is I run a blog called The Geek Anthropologist, where we spend a lot of time thinking about geek culture. And as people might remember, or they might not know about, in 2014, there was an incident of Gamergate, which was essentially when a lot of video game developers, particularly women and women of color, were targeted online by trolls. They were subjected to online harassment, to issues of cyber stalking. Some of them were doxxed. Many of them were hacked. And they experienced a very sort of prolonged period of cyber violence. And this was something that those of us in the geek community were following on a fairly regular basis, but was baffling a lot of people who were not quite as familiar with sort of video game and that sort of sector of the world. And I think from there, I was thinking a lot about what this form of online violence means, especially because there seemed to be this significant disconnect between how we think about quote-unquote offline violence, so regular gender-based or sexual-based violence, and then this online violence, which was perpetrated through different means, through places like Reddit and 4chan, but exhibited very similar kinds of patterns and traits. Later on, many of the women who were involved in Gamergate initially, like Anita Sarkeesian and Zoe Quinn, actually came to the UN when the UN was in the process of putting together a report on cyber violence that was ultimately released And this was one of the first sort of big gray papers discussing the issue of online violence, but actually got a lot of flack from communities who had been most impacted by Gamergate, in part because there seemed to be a lack of research or depth in terms of the ways that they were theorizing cyberviolence at the time. And so all of this to say, I had a internship at the International Center for Research on Women, and they were really interested in what the connections were between online and offline violence. And so my job was really to try to get a better sense of what was the literature out there that was being used to theorize this phenomenon, what were the gaps, and ideally the plan was then to use this literature review then to inform primary research that the International Center for Research on Women, ICRW, then went on to conduct in several countries around the world.
Okay, so you were doing this as part of your, was it a fellowship or what was the title for what you were doing with that organization? Was it
sure.
an internship
so
or fellowship?
Yes, so I was a master's student at George Washington University at the time, and I was an intern with ICRW in their violence and social inclusion portfolio.
Okay. All right. One of the things, you know, every field has its jargon and its vernacular, and I have to always remember that it's not just academics who listen to this program. So I want to make sure that any terminology we use is something that everybody understands. So you plowed into the existing research to find out what other people had found out is basically what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And you did this
mm-hmm.
in order to help inform further research on the connections between online and offline violence. Am I summarizing that correctly?
Yes. I think the only thing that I would add is that, so because the UN, the initial UN report on cyber violence was so heavily critiqued online, it led to a lot of other organizations like the World Bank, like the Sexual Violence Research Institute, SVRI, to basically realize that there needed to be a more fulsome research process to really understand the scope of this. And so that's sort of what the goal was for my research. I will say that initially the plan was primarily to only look at online violence and to get a better sense of what are the terms that are being used? What do we know about victims? What do we know about perpetrators? What do we know about tactics? What I found in the process of doing the research was that there was a clear continuum between online and offline violence. But I will say when I started the research process and when I was working with others at the ICRW team, we weren't necessarily anticipating that continuum as much.
Okay. So let me just give a brief anecdote. It sounds to me,
sure. It
reminds me of something in my past, which is many, many years ago, 110 years ago, I worked for a county probation department. And we had serious sex offenders, but we also had flashers. And the judges mm-hmm. and the courts in general, the attorneys, they kind of laughed at the flashers. And it was just kind of a joke. And nobody ever took them seriously as far as punishment or whatever. They'd get a little hand slap and that was it. And basically they were ha-ha, you know, wink-wink
mm-hmm.
at the flasher. Later research proved that this actually was a very serious offense that led to, you know, you've heard of the gateway drug kind of thing. And it was kind of a gateway behavior for perpetrators who were kind of testing the boundaries of appropriate acting out, and that many of these offenders later on would progress to greater sexual offenses. And it sounds to me like when I was reading through some of your stuff on and some other people's stuff on cyber stalking, it sounds to me like this also, the Cypress stalking thing, has been basically kind of poo-pooed, wink, wink, because nobody has indicated that that's part of a trajectory that becomes much more serious.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you found?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So one of the things that I definitely found was that for all the different kinds of cyber violence, and I tried to provide a bit of a typology, but this, a lot of others have sort of tried to typologize different forms of violence. And one of the issues with a typology is it makes it seem as though they're discrete, but a lot of the time you see sort of multiple forms of online violence happening sort of at the same time. So I talk about online harassment, cyberbullying, cyberstalking, and revenge porn. Each of these sort of relate to different tactics, but more often than not, if someone was a victim of, say, cyberstalking, and then chose to report it to the police, for instance, it was very much dismissed as something that was not as serious, was not as concerning. It was clear that for the researchers who had delved into this, oftentimes police officers are not specifically trained in what cyberstalking is or what the proper modes of sort of de-escalation might be. For other people who had experienced other forms of online violence who then chose to report to police, more often than not, one of the authors talked about the police basically telling the victim to turn off their phone or to unplug their computer, which I think sort of shows a fundamental misunderstanding of sort of how the internet works and sort of how dependent we are on it, but also the inability to realize just how significantly emotionally people are impacted by things like cyberstalking, but also how much other forms of online violence like hacking, like revenge porn, can actually have really devastating consequences for someone's education, for their housing situation, for their professional life. I can sort of go on. But I think that you're right in terms of a sense that it there still seems to be a sort of a misunderstanding of how devastating these forms of violence can really be for people who experience them.
Yeah. You also talk, well, you know, let's back up a little bit because, again, we're not necessarily speaking to folks who've studied cyber violence. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned several types of cyber abuse, if you will. Cyber stalking, mm-hmm. we've heard that terminology, but you mentioned a few others. Mm-hmm. Could you go into greater detail? What are the offenses, if you will, that can be carried out on the internet against a victim, and what do they mean? I mean, what is the definition of cyber stalking, and what are some of the other cyber offenses?
Sure. First I'll say two things. One is that one of the big findings of the meta-analysis that I did do is that there's not a lot of consensus on these terms or on these definitions. So I use the term cyber violence, but there's also sometimes it's referred to as technology facilitated gender-based violence. Sometimes it's online violence. Sometimes it's internet violence. Each of the sort of forms of cyber violence that I talk about often is referred to in multiple kinds of ways. So, for instance, there's cyber abuse, there's cyber aggression, there's digital dating abuse. And so one of the big sort of takeaways is that we have all of these terms that are being thrown around, but there actually isn't a consensus about what these different kinds of violence are. And that was hopefully what one of the big recommendations of the paper is, that we need to have a better understanding of what these terms mean. I had sort of broken it down into online harassment and cyberbullying as separate, but I think the reason that I separated the two of those was actually based more off of who was being written about. So when we think about online harassment, we usually think about someone who is receiving some kind of threat online, usually through some kind of digital interface. This might be Twitter, it might be Facebook, it might be Reddit. But that is actually not dissimilar from cyberbullying, but cyberbullying literature is often written about children. So it's usually youth or young adults sort of in primary or secondary school. And then we also have things like cyber dating violence or cyber dating abuse, which I think is sort of in a continuum with cyber stalking as well. So while cyber stalking is usually primarily referring to using some kind of tracking software to follow the movements or even just to follow the communication of a partner, cyber dating violence can encompass a lot more, a sort of broader range of behaviors. This might be, for instance, sending really coercive text messages to your partner. It can also involve impersonating your partner. This is often used in incidents of intimate partner violence. And in some cases, cyber dating abuse can transform into revenge porn or non-consensual pornography, which is usually when a explicit photo of someone is used and posted without their consent online. And so there are sort of these different modes, but there is a sort of slipperiness to the terminology. And I think you had asked initially about these as offenses. And one thing that I'll point out is that a lot of them are not necessarily considered to be criminal, that we actually, our criminal justice system is not really set up in a way to recognize these forms of violence as a criminal offense. So it's really only been recently that there have been laws introduced to criminalize something like revenge porn.
So there's this array, kind of slippery terminology for it, but I guess it's like art. We know it when we see it. How prevalent is this? Were you able to get from your research an idea of, you know, 1 in 3 women will be experiencing this? Is it primarily women? Because it seems like every time we talk about any kind of gendered violence right now, we have to add the caveat, men are abused too, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we have to look at the numbers and, you know, who is the most targeted, males or females? Is there a particular do gays get targeted more? I mean, what did you find in your research? Is there a particular group that's more vulnerable to these kinds of behaviors, these kinds of offenses?
So we found that there were some indications that women, young girls, and LGBTQIA individuals were the most likely to experience these forms of violence. I think one of the tricky things is that because there is not as much of a consensus about what the terms are, how we define this, there is also not a consensus in terms of research tools to be able to document this kind of data. So a lot of the data that we have is coming out of the Global North. So these are places like the US, Europe, and Australia. So we don't have as much data for places throughout Asia, Africa, Latin America, the South Pacific. There was a Pew study that was conducted in 2014 that found that 70% of 18 to 24-year-olds had experienced online harassment, which is a fairly high percentage. I think another thing to think about is because this is something that might not be discussed as frequently, and if we know that police officers, for instance, are not trained to handle these kinds of reports, it's likely highly underreported. And so the data that we do see is often coming out of academic surveys, and they're usually convenience samples of, usually it's high school or college-aged individuals. So
well,
we have
estimates. If I could interrupt you, yes, knowing that because your population sample that you're surrounded to when you're an academic is students, and so a
mm-hmm.
lot of research is done using that pool for participants. And as you point out, although there are older students, et cetera, the primary pool when you're talking college students is a younger demographic. You mentioned earlier
mm-hmm.
that a lot of the cyber stalking, cyber bullying affects mostly younger people, or at least that's what we're thinking, we're assuming at this point from the research. Does that then cast a little doubt on some of the studies that have been done as far as how it might apply to the general population? What about the validity does that age group of the survey pool, is that really going to give us a good reflection of how cyberbullying, cyber harassment affects the general population?
Well, I think so. We do have some data sort of beyond cyberbullying. I think what it relies on is sort of, like you said, a sort of consistency of tools in terms of, are you measuring behaviors? Are you measuring outcomes? I think one of the things to also consider here is the extent to which we are also asking the right kinds of questions. And so one of the things I'd like to sort of point out is that in terms of the general population, so one way that we have seen this manifesting is actually online violence against journalists and politicians. So we could see this, for instance, with the Katie Hill case, former senator, but we actually know that there are high rates of online harassment against journalists, particularly female journalists. Oftentimes on Twitter, but also it's meant that news organizations have had to increase moderation of comments on articles that are published by female journalists. We also know that there has been a lot of forms of online violence against female politicians or individuals who might be running for political office. And so the Women's Media Center, which is run by Soraya Shamale, has actually done a fair amount of research sort of trying to track what these global trends are. And then the research that I did for ICRW, they then went to the U.S., India, and Uganda to sort of provide a broader sample of this. So I think we're still trying to collect data on this in a way that is going to be consistent and is going to be comparable across different contexts.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. And when we're talking, you mentioned that the terminology, there's no really firm agreed upon definition for many of these terms. Did you find any particular topics that seem to generate more? It sounds to me like we're talking with kind of like two different pools of mm-hmm. victims. Personal victims, I'm your ex-husband and I hate your guts and so I'm going to do all this stuff, or I'm a former jilted lover or whatever, so I'm going to do all this. But when you're talking journalists and politicians, I'm presuming that it's a different level of motivation. Are there particular topics that seem to generate more of this behavior and this reaction for journalists and politics, or for politicians? What I'm getting at is, if you're a woman journalist and you write something about gender, is that more likely mm-hmm. to generate this kind of response than if you're a male journalist? That's kind of a wishy-washy question for you, but I think you're getting what I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of a broader question that is being posed of one of the reasons why someone might refer to this phenomenon more as technology-facilitated gender-based violence is that a lot of the vitriol that people are experiencing online does seem to be rooted in very particular gender ideologies. And so there is a sense of the extent to which patriarchy kind of pervades all of these different spaces. I think that I have a little section in the article where I talk about cyberfeminism and the ways that early cyberfeminism in sort of the 90s and early 2000s really was hoping that the internet would sort of be this pristine utopian place where we would be able to sort of rewrite or revision gender roles. But we know that in actuality, the very same sort of attitudes regarding male bias and male privilege of policing people's forms of speech, of being discomfited by certain arguments that are being posited by female journalists or politicians has actually been met by the same forms of anger that it was met with by when we were just in a form of print media. I think the other thing is that we have seen a rise in certain forms of the alt-right that really do organize online. And I have been thinking a lot, for instance, about the incel or the involuntary celibacy community that does specifically target women online, that these are all communities and tactics that manifest from very particular ideas about patriarchy that have then been able to mobilize online and use a lot of these very same tactics, usually to attack people who are sort of pointing out these forms of inequality and inconsistency and trying to cultivate potentially a more gender equitable world.
So then, and forgive me for just kind of thinking out loud here. So then, is the motivation of the cyber stalker, cyber bully, cyber perpetrator the topic or the author of that topic? Or can you tell it all? Because it seems to me if I were a male, for example, like they used to do in the Victorian times, you know, J. Scott, you know, that's the author, so that nobody knows that it's Judith as opposed to John. If I did that and wrote something about advocating for certain gender equality, advocating against the patriarchy, etc., well, is that the generator of the cyberstalking? Or if I put down Judith Scott, is that would John Scott get the same bullying as Judith in writing such a thing?
I think so. One of the issues is that we don't have a lot of data on perpetrators. That is a very difficult thing to collect information on, usually because the internet allows for so much anonymity, because we can sort of create these anonymous forms of communication, and someone is probably not likely to admit to having been a troll. So when ICRW did their research in the US, India, and Uganda, they also created their own spreadsheet where they talked about motivation. And I think the part of the reason why I broke down the different forms of violence is because I think that they're each rooted in a different kind of motivation of the perpetrator. So cyberstalking isn't always conducted by an intimate partner or a former intimate partner, but it usually is. And so in that case, we would see a very different level of motivation. It might be jealousy. It might be revenge. It might be sort of feeling hyperprotective of their partner or of their former partner. Whereas online harassment against, for instance, a journalist or a politician, that's likely coming from a very different kind of motivation because there isn't as much of a personal connection to that individual. And so I think in that case, it might be more of a political agenda or an ideological agenda. I think it's something that we still need to know more about, but it's, as I said, it's hard to sort of collect information because we can't just walk up to someone on the street and ask, hello, are you a perpetrator of cyber violence?
And if you find that person who says yes, yeah, you'd have to really kind of question, you know, okay, do I want this person in my study? Is he coming out and saying yes? I don't know. Okay. So I can understand that this is an extremely complicated issue, and it's complicated by the fact that we don't know a lot about the perpetrators. We don't know a lot about their motivation. We don't know a lot about the victims because the incidence of cyberbullying, cyberstalking, cyberviolence is totally underreported because in many cases it's not criminalized. Mm-hmm. So you get that kind of sets us up, if you're a victim of this, for, I think, some kind of mind screwing around with stuff. If I'm mm-hmm. a victim of this, we don't have research, we don't have knowledge about the perpetrator, we don't view it as a criminal offense, so how likely are we to have someone actually go and try and arrest this person or correct this person or punish this person? That must create a particular kind of psychological conflict for victims. Did your research include anything about the fallout, if you will, for victims of these cyber crimes, cyber attacks?
Yeah, so I will say that almost every article mentioned sort of the mental health consequences of this. It really runs the gamut from depression, anxiety, stress, feelings of isolation, what we might think of as post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. Within the cyberbullying literature, there is a sort of subset on cyberbully side where a child or a youth has been so severely bullied online that they actually choose to take their own life. There is also, you know, if someone is being cyber stalked, if they feel like they are being impersonated online, there is also just a general feeling of insecurity and of unsafety. And the literature indicates that more often than not, that these forms of offline violence or online violence then turn into forms of physical violence or sexual violence. So someone who might be cyber stalked might then experience physical stalking, which I'm sure you can imagine is extremely terrifying. And within that, you then have the mental health consequences of secondary victimization. So if you go to the principal at your school, if you go to the police station, if you go to a courtroom to try to get some kind of help or protection and are told that what you are experiencing is not severe or is not significant enough or simply doesn't have a legal architecture around it to protect you, that in itself can be highly traumatizing and can sort of reduplicate mental health consequences. I think that we don't really know. One of the things that is also still missing in the literature are sort of longitudinal studies that might track someone over a period of time to really get a better sense of what the mental health consequences are, but almost all the data indicates that it can be a highly traumatizing and highly isolating experience for people.
Mm-hmm. Is there much sympathy for this? If I go to, we can go into a greater discussion about people being sympathetic in the long term, but at least in the short term, if I go to my friends for coffee or whatever and I say, oh, my car was broken into, oh, the sympathy. If I say, mm-hmm. oh, I was physically attacked, ooh, the sympathy. And again, we can discuss for how long that actually lasts, but at least initially, the sympathy. Do victims of this particular offense, do they experience sympathy, or do they experience a lot of victim blaming, or do you not have that information?
So part of it depends on what kind of violence. So for issues like revenge porn or non-consensual pornography, a lot of people who experience that often find that they are victim blamed, in part because they might be told, well, you took the image, you took the sexually explicit image and you shared it with someone, and so you have sort of brought this on yourself. And there are really only a few lawyers who have really started to take on cases of revenge porn, and a lot of that is also sort of sensitizing the court system to the specificities of this. We know that because the criminal justice system is not particularly sensitive or does not really have enough adequate information, a lot of people really turn to informal support networks. And these might be friends or family, which ideally are a little bit more sympathetic. I think the other sort of platform to consider are virtual or digital platforms themselves, right? So, for instance, a lot of advocates have talked about the moderation practices of places like Facebook or Twitter, and that for a long time, if you want to report someone on Twitter, initially, more often than not, it was the person who was reporting who got booted off of Twitter rather than the person that was harassing them. And so even just thinking about the policies and protocols of digital platforms are only just now sort of starting to be sympathetic to, I think, the forms of harassment that people are experiencing.
That's a typical trajectory, though, as we learn more and find out how prevalent and learn more about the long-term effects. I think we as a culture tend to take these things more seriously. At first, as I say, we go back to the wink, wink, nudge, nudge of the, you know, the exposer, you know, in the alley kind of thing. But once we understand more about the seriousness of it, then I think most people in our culture tend to take it more seriously. But sometimes that can take decades to reach that point. I would like to talk a little bit about, we talked about the motivations, and we don't really, you indicated that the literature is pretty bare on what would motivate a person. I think it's pretty clear in what I'm calling that personal, the personal attacks. You're the jilted lover, you're the abusive ex-husband, but whatever. But for these people that I guess we're calling them trolls, who and I'll be honest with you, our web, you know, Three Women Three Ways, we get our trolls. You know, I'll post a photo of somebody who's talking about a very serious topic, and invariably there will be some man. I've never had a woman doing it. That will, you know, make aspersions on that expert's appearance or something like that, as if they had a right to comment on it. So when you are talking about the kind of the subset of people who will just scan the internet or just go to different sites or just, it almost seems like they're looking for something where they can, I don't know, is there any more better understanding of why these strangers do it? You had talked a little bit about the anonymity that is available on the internet. Certainly that must play a part, but what else do you know about those kinds of perpetrators?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I mention anonymity because there is sort of a subset of psychologists that think that because people can be anonymous online, they feel liberated to do things and to say things that they wouldn't necessarily be able to do if they were able to be identified. I think another thing that we can think about is the way that because this perpetration is not occurring face-to-face, the individuals don't have to sort of see the consequences of their actions. They don't have to witness in real time the extent to which what they're saying or doing is harming the person that they're directing that abuse at. And there's still research that needs to be done in terms of what role that might play. I think the other thing is thinking about what the motivation is behind sort of trolling as a very broad category. And I think that that's something that we're still sort of trying to dig into. There are several scholars, I'm thinking of in particular someone like Whitney Phillips, who's done an ethnography of trolling and actually works on harassment against journalists now, who talks a lot about sort of the through line of misogyny and the level of anger and the ways in which a lot of the time these forms of abuse is sort of a very explicit policing of what certain marginalized groups can or cannot say. And that oftentimes it's coming from a place of intense pain of that man or of that individual feeling wronged personally, feeling like there were privileges and opportunities that they didn't necessarily have access to. And in those cases, a lot of the time, feminism is sort of to blame for this. And so there's been a lot of discussion about sort of the extent to which this behavior is kind of motivated by a sort of misogyny noir that is being amplified on the internet.
Misogyny noir. That's an interesting term. I've not heard that one before. Explain to me a little bit more what that means, if you would.
That's a good question. I guess it is that it is typically used to refer to a more intersectional understanding of misogyny, that it is not simply misogyny based off of sex or gender, but it is also oriented around race and ethnicity. So, for instance, we can think about the ways that, like Roxane Gay, for instance, has been targeted for a lot of online harassment. We've seen a lot of African American women, journalists, comedians being targeted for online harassment. And so it's a term that sort of attempts to recognize that there are sort of multiple levels of misogyny that are co-occurring at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. I want to move back a little bit to the police response or the authority mm-hmm. response to this. You mentioned in your blog that a lot of because the internet is not perceived as real. I'm just going to read what you wrote because it's interesting to me. Yet, because the internet isn't seen as real, many victims of cyberviolence find their experiences are trivialized. They are told to simply disconnect their computers, turn off their cell phones. And I would like to know whether you think that's changing. Did you find any indication in the studies that there's a shift in that, or there are some areas that are taking it more seriously? My sense is that police departments are probably so overburdened right now that if somebody isn't left bleeding, they might just go, whoa, you know, we'll just deal with it. We'll put that on the agenda for the next biennium or something. What did you find?
I will say that, you know, they're sort of as a rule, and I'm sort of speaking a little bit more from a U.S. context and then also knowing about the South African context, more often than not, the criminal justice system, and especially the police, are not known to be particularly friendly towards issues of gender-based violence. And I think that this is most certainly another sort of iteration of gender-based violence, sort of in a different form. We know that very rarely are sort of specialized services or trainings offered that would sensitize people towards the issues of GBV. And more often than not, it's sort of a one-off presentation that happens once a year that everyone is is mandated to go to. So I think if it is happening, it is certainly not happening on a national level. It might be happening on a more localized level, but if it is, it's probably sort of in response to cases that might be emerging. I would say that a lot of the pressure is being placed on sort of specialized lawyers who have sort of taken up some of these issues and have really tried to work very specifically with police stations in their area to try to create a little bit more sensitization around it. I will say that the UN has sort of announced that there needs to be a greater attention to this issue of cyber violence, but the extent to which that has really trickled down into police stations, I think, is still pretty minimal.
Mm-hmm. In what way, in your ideal world after doing your research, what would be the ideal police response?
Well, so I will also say that I'm someone who, having worked with a lot of advocates who do not support carceral feminism, and by this I mean not necessarily wanting to invest in necessarily criminalizing these kinds of things. I think that there is a debate that is being had about the extent to which criminalizing might actually reduplicate harms against marginalized communities. I think I'm not sure if I necessarily would want the police to be more involved. I think really the first step is for greater accountability at multiple levels. So it is both sort of an intervention at on the platforms. I think another thing is that one of the biggest sort of barriers to recognizing this issue as something that should be protected against is the Communications Decency Act, which essentially allows third-party platforms to post non-consensual pornography and basically call it free speech. And so what I would actually say is the first step for me would be working with survivors and with the lawyers that have a lot more experience with this issue and trying to figure out ways that we can really adjust platforms and I would also honestly say holding companies more accountable, because for instance a lot of perpetrators who commit incidents of cyber stalking purchase the software that they use to commit that cyber stalking from local companies. And I think in that case, we have a clear sense of the fact that there needs to be a greater accountability for companies and organizations as well. So I would actually start there personally.
Okay. That is an interesting response, I think, because I'm sure I'm considerably older than you. And I must say that one of the things that just tickles at the back of my neck is the loss of individuality that we seem to be having. When you're talking about a better solution being the internet, the platforms, the corporations, I appreciate that and I understand it, but there's that little niggling in the back of me. What about the individual? What about that individual? Do you see where I'm going with that? Do you see my sense of unease with some of that?
In terms of the actual individual support that a survivor might need, you mean?
No, I'm talking in as far as responsibility and accountability for behaviors.
Yeah, I mean, I think, we still have to find a way to address violent behaviors. And I think that there are a lot of different models that are being piloted around the world. And I think that is, there's a professor that I work with who has been working with survivors of sexual violence for, you know, over 50 years. And one of the questions he posed to me recently is can we end gender-based violence in our lifetime? And I think that that is the question, is how do we change individual behaviors around gender-based violence? Because we do have some great models that are doing some good work and are able to change individual behaviors within a lifetime. But can we do that at a society-wide level? Can we do that at a global level? I don't know. You'll have to ask. My answer changes depending on how optimistic I feel on a given day.
Yeah. Well, and you were saying that this professor has been doing his work for more than 50 years, and his question was, can we change this in our lifetime? And I'm thinking, how old are you? Because I'm not seeing it happening anytime terribly soon.
Right.
Perhaps in your lifetime, my lifetime, something so. So, you know, that clock ticks, it just keeps ticking. One of the final questions that I have for you regards ethical issues. I found when I was reading your materials that was an interesting point that, shame on me, I hadn't really thought about. When you talk about ethical issues surrounding cyber violence, what are you talking about?
Well, I think one of the things is I think it's something that I think about a lot as someone who is a researcher on gender-based violence. And so the ways that you collect data around gender-based violence, we have to be exceptionally careful that our data methods do not re-traumatize, are not triggering, do not put people in a position where they are potentially more vulnerable to violence. And so ethically, we have to figure out particular kinds of ways to gather this data that is not going to reduplicate the harm that people have experienced, especially if it means reopening old wounds, but then not offering them solutions. So I think a lot about extractive research, and we absolutely need data to sort of guide evidence-based interventions and policies, but then especially for issues regarding gender-based violence, a lot of people say that if you're going to be doing research with survivors, you have to make sure that you have mental health care protocols and counseling in place. You have to make sure that you have referrals in place. You have to make sure basically that you're creating a safe space for that person to talk about their experience and ensuring that if they need additional support, you can provide that to them. And I think because this is still such a nascent issue, we don't have as many of those referral resources. We don't have as many of those places that we can refer people to. I think a sort of flip side of the ethics is also, how do we do research with perpetrators? What kinds of research with perpetrators do we feel comfortable with? I know that this is a conversation that other scholars have had who work with perpetrators in prisons or in other contexts. And so it's not only about sort of what are we asking of survey or study participants, but also what are we asking of ourselves in doing this kind of research?
Okay. So you're looking at the ethical issues from the standpoint of the researcher.
From the researcher, but also of what we are able to give to participants, and make sure that we are we're not hurting them in the process of doing that research.
Yeah. Do you see any conflict between feminism and using the internet? Where I'm going here is, If we start placing restrictions on internet use, i.e. responses from trolls, etc., will that then also lead to restrictions from any other users? What brought this to mind is I post on Facebook the Three Women, Three Ways speakers, And several months ago, I had a candidate who was running for Supreme Court in Louisiana, and he was running on a feminist ticket. And I thought that was very unique. And so I had him on the show, and Facebook pulled it. They pulled it. And I went, huh, okay. All righty. So apparently feminism is now political speech. I don't know. The whole thing, and plus, you know, I mean, you can't do anything without realizing that there are repercussions, fallout that you're not even going to see. So I guess what I'm asking is to speculate, based on your research, on whether any kind of restrictions, policies, interventions that we can come up with that would mitigate cyber violence would then also interfere with other aspects of communication.
Well, I guess I'm not sure if this quite answers your question, but it's something I've been thinking a lot in terms of net neutrality and the ways that we need net neutrality so that marginalized communities are able to mobilize and are able to have a voice on the internet. I think that there is a tendency sometimes to say, you know, the internet is garbage or Twitter is garbage, or that the internet is a wonderful thing. And like, the internet is neither good nor bad. It is a production and a creation of its users. And that the internet has actually facilitated a huge amount of feminist organizing. I mean, we could think about the ways that the Women's March began on Facebook. In the South African context, for instance, there was a hashtag called Total Shutdown that basically led to a mass mobilization that was all facilitated online. I think that right now, as we're thinking about how to deal with the lockdown around coronavirus and getting people access to resources, the internet is really an essential tool. I think that the difference is that oftentimes abusive behaviors masquerades itself behind freedom of speech, and I think that we need to do a little bit more thought parsing out those two things.
Thank you. Emma Louise Bakke, I can't believe it. I'm looking at the clock, and we're almost out of time. I do very quickly, though, want to ask you, was there something that, you know, obviously I'm just reading your materials. I'm not an expert. Is there something you think is very important about this topic that I perhaps neglected to ask you?
This is something that is occurring, I think, more frequently now that we are all stuck in our homes. I was having a conversation earlier today with some service providers who have created online hotlines to provide services to survivors of gender-based violence who are in lockdown, and that they're actually finding prank callers, so people who are coming in to prank those hotlines. And I think that this just goes to show that this is sort of another form of violence, and it's coming as a surprise to many service providers, which I think goes to show how much work still needs to be done in terms of sort of connecting all of these different digital dots.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. It's a fascinating topic. It's a topic that unfortunately is going to affect a lot of us. And interesting, obviously requires more research down the road. But thank you so much for sharing with us what you learned in your meta-analysis of the current literature. And I hope that in your future you are going to be continuing to do research along these lines. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Bakke. And people can just Google your name and go to the blogs and the research that you have. And so we are glad to be able to share that. So thank you, and thank you for listening to Three Women, Three Ways.